This is episode 1-1 of Free as in Freedom for Tuesday, June 7th, 2011 of the Common Era. Well, welcome everybody to another episode of Free as in Freedom, and I have a very special co-host again. Dan, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry, I was wondering what I thought you were going to say something else about that. I don't know about very special. It depends on your definition of the word special, I suppose. It's great to be here again. I was curious actually because you last time we spoke a couple of weeks ago, you were preparing for Karen's wedding that evening. So how did it all go? Was it all go okay?
Oh yeah, it went fine. She had the wedding. There was no gate crashers from the internet who saw her invitation and decided to show up. It was all people who were supposed to be there. It looked like, it was good to go. It started kind of late for me. I go to bed early, so I ended up leaving relatively early because it started at 7:30. And so by the time we finished dinner, it was almost 11:30. So wow. I was just like, well, I need to get out of here. But Karen's a late person, so I assume they skewed their wedding time for a late night. So I don't know how late it went. I left relatively early. I stayed for dinner and dessert, and yeah. They didn't have a cake actually. That was interesting. They just had dessert, which I think was good. I mean, the whole cake thing, especially in the U.S., there's this whole like. I don't know what to call it. It's not really a tradition. It's more,
fashion?
And sort of vulgar than a tradition, like this thing with the cake and the bring it out. And then the bride and groom like shove it in each other's faces. And it's like a thing people do. And it's really stupid at weddings. I hate when people do that. So I actually really like the Karen's wedding didn't do any of that stuff. It was a very, very classy event. It was good. I was glad to be invited and glad to go. My wife and I went and it all worked out. And I think, Karen is still away. She's been away, since the wedding. So you're here to graciously fill in and be the co-host on Free as in Freedom.
I am, but I think she'll be back next time. So anybody who's missing Karen's voice on the show will hopefully be able to hear that again next time, I think.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think she ran away permanently. It was just for after the wedding. So she'll be back for the next show, I'm sure.
Brilliant. Yeah, it sounds good. And we'll have people posting sightings on the internet now, you know, unconfirmed news that she's been seen wherever. Should be cool. We're going to do something slightly different, aren't we? Slightly different for this show anyway, in that we were kind of talking over the last couple of weeks about what we could discuss and so on, and fortunately for us, as often seems to happen in the free software open source world, some fairly big news has come up that we can talk about.
Yeah, and so Karen and I occasionally we've talked about a recent topic or something that's going on, but it's really not been our tendency to do a news story or current events and analyze them. I mean, we have done it on occasion, but it's not really our typical thing. But because of your experience with Linux Outlaws, you've done a lot of that, and so I think it was a good idea for the show that you're joining me as the co-presenter to chase some of the stories and sort of relate to what the kinds of topics that we talk about on Free as in Freedom, the things like licensing and policies for projects and those sorts of things. So we've picked a couple of topics I think that are good that we can talk about. So the first one was your idea. So do you want to sort of introduce it for the listeners?
Yeah. I suppose to give the backstory, I got a couple of emails actually from various different people through my personal email. From people I think who'd either watched or listened to Floss Weekly and had ideas for starting new projects. In one case, it was a hardware project. They wanted to start an open hardware project, and another guy who wanted to start a free software project, and they asking me for advice. And really, I'm not the guy to give advice on that. Given the kind of wider context of like the news at the moment with CentOS, which is, I'm sure everyone listening to this will know, it's a fairly technical audience, but is a community repackaged version of Red Hat Enterprise Linux. that they're having some organizational problems at the moment, and their kind of structure of their of their project and their governance and stuff is effectively killing the project, which is a shame. So I thought we could talk about some ideas around what's going on there, and also how maybe you could set up your project well initially to try and, you know, mitigate those problems down the road. Yeah, so I mean, something you've had a lot more experience of, and I believe you've written a blog post on this as well, which we'll reference.
Yeah, I have.
In the show notes.
So do you want to talk through the CentOS situation and then we'll get to the other stuff at the end? So maybe we should bring, we've mentioned the CentOS situation briefly on Free Isn't Freedom, but I don't think we've gone too much into it. But you actually interviewed the folks on Floss Weekly when you were, because you're sort of one of the rotating co-hosts on Floss Weekly these days. So do you want to sort of bring people up to speed who might not have heard that episode, sort of what you learned from that and how it all played out?
Yeah. Well, at the time, I think it was about, I forget, this is bad, but I forget exactly when it was.
It was a couple months ago.
Probably about 6 months ago. Well, it was more than 2 weeks ago. I know that. It was a while ago. I interviewed Karen Beer Singh, who is the current leader of the CentOS project. And at that time, none of these problems, well, certainly publicly, they weren't known about. If they were happening in the background, I don't know, but they weren't publicly known about. But I was quite surprised when we spoke to him. One of the things I always like to try and find out when we talk to projects is how many people are involved and how people can get involved and how open their development model is. And he basically told me there's literally a handful of people who work on CentOS. I think it's like five or six or something like that, who work kind of full-time on not full-time, but, you know, have like main stakeholders in CentOS. I think a lot of them actually work for other companies doing other things, and they do CentOS in their free time or their spare time. I don't know if there's anyone employed full-time to work on it, but when we discussed it, I asked him how people could get involved, and it was quite interesting because he kind of gave an answer that a lot of projects wouldn't give on something like Floss Weekly. Something that surprised me was they have what they like to call a kind of whether you'd call it a vetting process or something, but they say they like to keep the technical bar very high for people who work on CentOS. It all seems very elitist to me, and I'm not sure I like it, but the reason that the developer community is so small is because basically that they want people who are only the best of the best of the best or whatever, and they try and keep that bar very high, which on one hand I can kind of see the merit of if you that's what you want to do, but at the same time it limits your access to community resources and to other help and other developers. And the situation at the moment seems to be we've had quite a few prominent people who've tried to get involved with CentOS or who have at various times been involved with CentOS basically have said that they can't get anything done because they're, you know, the grip that this core group have got on control of the project is so tight and they can't do anything with it. So it's kind of almost like a closed development model. And we had some criticism from some of the developers that the model is too closed and they're going to move to other things because of this. And unfortunately, I mean, CentOS 5, as I said, CentOS is a repackaging or a redistribution of Red Hat Enterprise Linux. And as many people might know listening to this, Red Hat Enterprise Linux 6 came out a fair while ago now, and 6.1 is out. At the moment, there's no sign of CentOS 6 at all. And lots of people are getting very nervous about that, and it looks like it may not even happen. And they're actually they're working on 5.6, which is a repackaging of Red Hat 5.6, which is almost out of date now anyway. I mean, they have long-term support and so on, but it's almost out of date. And it just doesn't seem to be going anywhere. And lots of people, because one thing I found amazing for a project with so few developers is how important that CentOS has been to the web hosting industry and stuff like that. So many web hosts rely on it. Big companies rely on it. And I find it really strange that with such an important project that, some of these companies don't get together and employ some people to work on it full time and get things going. But that's the kind of situation at the moment. There's a lot of doom and gloom being talked around CentOS, which is sad.
Yeah. And I think that those community problems are in some ways a trickle down effect from the way that RHEL is developed. Mm. So you have RHEL being developed. Basically, actually, I want to go back in time first. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the way Red Hat was, and it was called, the distribution was called Red Hat back in the 90s. That was the product. And Red Hat was developed in a relatively open way. Most of the employees, of the Red Hat company were working on it. It wasn't like it was a huge community project, but they've developed in a reasonably open way, and the releases were open and available in the usual types of ways and so forth. And then as the RHEL model got developed, and the RHEL model is, and I've written about the RHEL model a lot on my blog about how it basically walks right up to the line of GPL, but doesn't cross it. So mm-hmm. it's basically as close as you could get to violating the GPL without violating it. And so it's really designed to encourage people to buy these site licenses for support. And because of that, it's a very secretive way that it's distributed. So I think when someone gets a copy of RHEL, which they have to do to build CentOS, there's sort of all this secrecy involved around it. And I think that trickles down into the CentOS community. In fact, I don't even know, I still don't know to this day, exactly how CentOS gets access to a copy of RHEL, because it's very difficult to redistribute RHEL. It's allowed under GPL, but Red Hat will cancel your contract.
Right.
If you engage in redistribution, which is, it's not a GPL violation. I think it's a nasty thing to do, but it's rare that somebody will give you a copy of RHEL. Like if you go to a company that's bought a site license for support, they're unlikely to want to give you a copy. Now, they don't have to give you a copy. GPL doesn't require distribution, but they're actually afraid they're going to piss Red Hat off by giving you a copy. So I don't even know how that stuff trickles down at the CentOS community in the first place. But I also think that because RHEL has this secretive model, it sort of makes CentOS a sort of weird thing. And I think you're quite right that a lot of companies depend on CentOS. And I think Red Hat sort of lost their way with regard to the way that they developed the server operating system, because the server operating system is their product, and CentOS actually drives sales to them. I've been told by Red Hat engineers that when they often get us a support request, and actually it's for CentOS, and they tell people, well, you need to buy a license for RHEL, not a license for the software, but a support license for RHEL if you want help on this. And then people do, right? So they go to Red Hat, they ask for support on CentOS. Red Hat says, well, we don't support CentOS. You have to get support for RHEL for us to help you. And then they buy it. So CentOS is actually a marketing arm for RHEL. So instead of like basically most Red Hat people are sort of like, oh, CentOS is kind of a competitor to RHEL. I mean, I think that's the way most of the salespeople at Red Hat think. But it's not. It's actually their marketing arm. And they understand this with Fedora, right? I mean, Fedora is also a marketing arm for Red Hat as well. And so I don't see why they don't help CentOS be a more open community where they can get that kind of interest and get people using it, and it would sell Red Hat support contracts if they did it that way. I don't understand why Red Hat has to think that way about RHEL. It doesn't make sense to me. I don't think it helps their business model, frankly.
Yeah, it's strange. I mean, one of the things I've kind of gleaned from talking to various Red Hat technical people, I've got to confess, I don't really talk to the salespeople that often, so I don't know whether their attitude is different. But I mean, obviously the engineers often have a different attitude to that kind of thing anyway. They seem quite supportive of CentOS in principle and so on. And when I spoke to some of their engineers, they were talking about the fact that they tried to make it easier for CentOS to repackage what they do by putting all of their branding into specific packages that can be removed to make it easier. So that's what I find strange when you were saying about, I don't know, I've never really thought about it. I always assumed that somewhere you could make a request for source to Red Hat for Red Hat Enterprise Linux or whatever. You could make a request for source, and that was what CentOS were doing, getting the source and then repackaging, whatever. So it's interesting. But one of the things I did find out from talking to some of the Red Hat people is that there are, as you say, there are, I think, a small set of packages that make the difference between CentOS and Red Hat Enterprise. And what they will do is if you are a CentOS user and you go to them and say, I need support. I've got this problem with this, that, or the other. They will say, as you said, they will sell you a support license, a Red Hat support license. And often what they will do is run these package updates, which converts your CentOS box into a Red Hat Enterprise Linux box, which I find really interesting. They will actually add these packages for you and say, okay, that's good. Now you've got RHEL, you know, now you've got the same product. So it is very strange. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's completely reasonable for them to do that. Obviously, if they only want to support their own product, that's their prerogative, and of course they should only support their own product. And that just goes to support the idea that CentOS really is a marketing arm for them. And the thing you mentioned about making it easy for developers, I mean, I know lots of Red Hat developers bring that up when you bring up CentOS, but that was a long time ago when that was done. I mean, that was a very different Red Hat that did that. And that actually goes all the way back to the very early days of Red Hat Linux. The trademark removal, the easy trademark removal stuff was added way back then before RHEL ever existed.
Right.
So it's a little bit disingenuous to say, oh yeah, we did that for the CentOS developers. I mean, RHEL didn't even exist when that was done. And it just was carried on into RHEL. So I'm troubled by the whole situation. I think the problems from CentOS actually come from upstream. I think that the way RHEL is structured is sort of influencing how the CentOS community is structured. And I think it leads to the problems in the CentOS community. I think secrecy breeds secrecy. I think the way the CentOS developers think, that thing you saw about them not wanting people to be involved, it comes from the fact that they have to clandestinely try to get copies of RHEL. It could be they've had trouble getting RHEL 6, right? Because I don't know how, like I said, I don't know how you would go about getting all the sources to RHEL 6, because you have to receive distribution of RHEL from Red Hat to actually have a right to ask for the source. And the only way I know that you can receive distribution from Red Hat is to become a service customer. And of course, they cancel your service contract if you redistribute. So I always figured that there was a little cabal of people who go around like buying a RHEL license. Cause that's the whole thing about RHEL. RHEL is designed around your money's no good here if you exercise your rights under GPL. So if they know you're a CentOS developer, they probably won't even sell you a support contract.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've got images of from all those years of watching X-Files of that, you know, meeting that people in the bottom of a multi-story car park or something like that. Deep Throat guy, when they used to go and meet him in a car park somewhere.
Even the smoking man.
Yeah, and that's right. And they'd like, you know, get, maybe that's how they get a copy of RHEL. I don't know. By leave it in a dustbin and then leave 10 minutes before the next person comes past and opens the bin to take it out. I don't know. I'm not sure, but I mean, to be fair, to play devil's advocate a little bit, I know that the Red Hat people would probably say that Fedora is upstream of RHEL and Fedora is open, so they feel that that's an open model or something. I don't know. What do you reckon to that?
Well, I think that Fedora was designed to be a research arm. That's when the whole thing happened, where Red Hat Linux sort of died out, and they said, well, we want to have a server operating system. We want to have a lot more control over it. They designed the RHEL model. And then Fedora was basically the spinoff project, which was designed to be sort of the research arm for RHEL. I think that's how people, management inside Red Hat, I don't know what they think, but my impression of what they think is that they look at Fedora as basically R&D. They get stuff together, put it into Fedora, make a distribution, and then the RHEL people come along and pick and choose from that to decide what they're going to make stable, what worked, you know, like the systemd thing, right? So that's a great example. I'm sure, I don't know this for sure because I don't know what's in RHEL 6, but I don't think systemd is there yet in RHEL. And what's happening is they've got Leonard working for Red Hat, developing this new startup system. It's being put into Fedora early. It's sort of a researchy thing. It doesn't work fully yet, but it's getting there. And then eventually when Red Hat inside people see that systemd is stable and it's working, they'll move it into RHEL. And so that's a great example of how it's basically an R&D arm of RHEL. And I think that's how they structured it inside the company. So I think the developers are right that basically what's in Fedora today is probably the RHEL of tomorrow. But there's a real interesting editorial process that Red Hat's doing, and that's sort of their special sauce, is they're deciding what's stable enough to be in RHEL. And then the CentOS guys on the other end are sort of spinning it around and saying, well, we're getting the sort of downstream output of their editorial process from Fedora to RHEL, and then we're going to get out there and put it as a server operating system. I think you're right. That's why CentOS is so important, because these web server companies want to use CentOS because it's the editorial process that came out of Fedora to RHEL that they want to get access to. That's why they don't want to run their web services on Fedora. I think that's what's happening. I think it's sort of a dysfunctional community because it's all sort of being washed through Red Hat in this weird business model. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely right. That I this is purely a personal opinion, obviously, but I wouldn't run my servers on Fedora. And I know most people, there are some people who do, but I know other people who would agree, just because it is prone to, experimental features and things that might break. And that definitely pushes you towards the Red Hat Enterprise model, in that Fedora, they're not making Fedora as a stable product. They're making it, as you say, as the R&D arm, which is interesting. I suppose in comparison to something like the Debian model, which other people would know, I would think of Fedora as being more like testing or unstable, and RHEL being a bit more like Debian stable, in that if you want a stable guarantee, well, not guaranteed, but if you want a stable as solid as it can be distribution for your server, which is, if you've got any brains, is what you do want for your server, then you've got to get the stable model, and that is RHEL at the moment, it seems. Yeah, so it's interesting, but I don't know, branching out a little bit to the kind of the wider question I was saying about what people have been asking me. This is a tough question, but I'm going to ask you anyway. How do you think they could structure things differently, or how should a project structure things in the initial phases to try and hopefully mitigate this thing? I know you talk about the replicant thing with the FSF, and if Microsoft took over the FSF and replaced everyone. So I imagine that's similar to it as well. How do you maintain a kind of open governance model and so on?
Well, I think it's, and we're going to talk a little bit more about this when we talk about the LibreOffice, OpenOffice situation. I think it's really, really tough to pull off in a case like this, where you have the giant gorilla in the room, right? So when you look at something like CentOS, it's really tough to build a community out of something where you're effectively reliant on a closed model. I mean, it's basically a closed model of a company in control of the code base. It's much easier. And actually, I'm going to link online to a couple of different articles that I think are good. A guy named his username's Quaid. He works. His name's Carsten.
Oh, Carsten Wade.
Yeah. Carsten Wade. Yeah, he works for Red Hat, ironically enough. But he wrote a really nice thing called the Open Source Way. Mm. And it's a good article to sort of explain how to do community development. It's actually more of a book. And also, Carl Foger wrote a really good book on maintaining and producing open source software that sort of explains how to keep your community strong. But I think neither of them really talk about how to build your community from the start. I do have that blog post you mentioned, which it's called Where Are the Bytes, which I'll also link it to in the show notes. And actually, that's a little bit about starting a project. And my main point in that blog post is get the stuff out there early and often and keep it developed in public. I really feel like the way to make sure your project has that kind of community health is make sure everything happens in public. And it's really tough to do when you have a lot of developers sort of centered in a company. And I know Mozilla struggles with this all the time, because they've got a lot of Mozilla developers sitting at the offices of the Mozilla Corporation doing the work, and they talk to each other, and humans they have a tendency to want to talk in person. It's like basically evolved into us for thousands and tens of thousands of years that we interact in person. So a lot of things don't get documented on the mailing lists and on IRC and other online fora. So a lot of people who are developers contributing to Mozilla don't feel like they're in the team, because the team is actually physically there in Mountain View at the Mozilla Corporation offices. So I think it's really, and this is the same problem you have with CentOS and RHEL, and the fact that RHEL is basically developed by engineers at Red Hat internally. It's even worse there, because they're not even trying to talk to the CentOS developers. And so I think developing in public is really the first thing you've got to do. It's basically the prerequisite to really have a community that's healthy and that doesn't have these kinds of problems.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, as I said, I've been asked this question a few times lately, which is strange. I mean, I don't know why people would ask me that question, because I don't have a history of making successful free software projects, so I'm probably not the best guy to ask. But I think they were basically asking me what they needed to think about up front before they got started, or what were the things they should consider. And I think my response was definitely think about what license you're going to use, and make sure that you are, you know, you're definite about what license you want to use, why you want to use it, and why you want to, you know, build the community around that. Make sure you pick the one that's best for you. Obviously, I have my opinions, and I know you do, on what license would be best, but I suppose that's up to the project.
Oh, I just wanted to add on the licensing point. I think that's absolutely correct. And this is gonna really lead on to the next segment, because I think the license that a community builds around basically becomes your constitution of the community. That's basically your declaration document of, this is our principle in this project. This is what we believe in. Because licenses, I believe, are moral documents. They say, this is what our community is. And you're absolutely right. Once the license is picked, I think it's really important that the community stick around that license and stick with that license. I mean, obviously you can change a license, and it can be done, and it should be done in some cases. But it needs to be community consensus. You need to make sure that the whole community wants that license to be this changed, and you should only do it with great care. If you change a license, you should generally pick the license and stick with it, and as you said, morally justify, write up why you picked it, and make all that, and again, going back to what I said before, make that public, and make all your thinking public about why you're leading the projects in the way that you are.
Yeah, and as you said, that does lead very nicely into our next topic. So, if anybody wants to know more about that kind of how, you know, topics to think about if you are looking to start a project, as Bradley said, we'll have some links to some useful documents in the show notes and so on. But unfortunately, it doesn't seem like I was asking you this yesterday. I suppose it's hard, but there is no kind of guide, no definitive guide anywhere for, you go through X amount of steps and then you've got, you know, everything sorted you need to move forward and start writing code or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think both Karsten's and Carl's books do touch on this topic. I think they're mostly geared towards, you've kind of got it going now, how do you make sure you don't screw up more than they are getting started? But I think there is some advice in those books that would be helpful to people getting started too.
Yeah, and I think I don't know whether you agree with this, but in my experience with kind of coding projects and stuff, people, developers, I mean, we're all, in my experience, we're all fairly pragmatic, and we want to get going and we want to start writing code. We don't want to sit down and spend 3 days working out what license to use and all that kind of stuff. So a lot of times it's like an afterthought. And even if you look at, say, the Linux kernel, that was never started as a GPL project. It was just relicensed under that for whatever reason back in, you know, years ago. And it was never thought about upfront.
The reason Linus gives is, he says, well, I made it under a non-commercial license, and then people were asking me about selling CDs, and then I didn't know what to do, and then I just picked GPL because it was there in GCC. So you're right, that it was an afterthought, in the sense that he just said, well, I use GCC a lot, so I'll just use its license.
Yeah. Yeah, and looking back on it, I know we're getting off the topic here a little bit, but looking back on it now, I mean, that's been quite an important decision for a lot of what's come later. But that's the thing, that's what I'm saying. I think people need to kind of think a little bit before. We all want to get in there and start writing code and stuff, but if you go too far down that road and start pushing your project to forward technically without any kind of direction or governance model, you're going to create problems which will rear their heads later on, as we're seeing with a lot of projects now.
I think that the future is hopeful. I mean, everybody who listens to the show knows I'm somewhat of a pessimist, but on this point, I'm a little bit of an optimist, because I think the level of knowledge and understanding about licenses and why you choose them and so forth is really raising in the community. I had an interesting discussion on Identica this past week, where I was pointing out that this is way off topic, but I think it's worth mentioning because it sort of exemplifies the point. There's certain people who want to abolish copyright altogether and think that copyright's in the way. And it's actually Fab, your co-host in Linux Outlaws, who was bringing up, well, if we abolish copyright because other mechanisms are used to proprietorize software other than copyright. Obviously copyright is used, but also various different EULAs and patents and all these other systems can be used to proprietorize software. software that we can't just get rid of copyright, because copyleft is sort of the only thing we have defending the freedom of free software, and it uses copyright. So we can't just abolish copyright unilaterally. We have to make sure there's a way to keep free software free without copyright. And that's a concept that it actually took me probably a decade to really understand, because I used to kind of be a copyright abolitionist. And then I started to realize, well, wait a second. If we abolish copyright, what happens to copyleft and what happens to free software? And thinking through that, it took me quite a number of years. And the fact that that's just sort of the default thinking, Fab and I were sort of going back and forth on this. I was really impressed that he had figured this out. And he pointed out that, well, this is a, we've reached a moment in the history of free software that it's like calculus, right? Calculus, everybody learns it, in usually like their senior year of high school or the first year of college if they do math, any sort of math. And it's sort of just like a fundamental math tool that you learn. But there was a time when calculus was the area of research. Like Isaac Newton sat down and Leibniz sat down and worked out calculus, right? And it was new research. And now it's just taught as, oh, this is exists, you know? And it's a thing. You have to learn. It's like basically like arithmetic now. And so that's happened a lot in our community. The level of knowledge as we've grown up as a community over a period of 30, 40 years, we've built a level of knowledge that's just common knowledge. And I think that's really valuable. And that's making this issue easier, because people don't just start projects and be like, oh, I'll make it a non-commercial license. I mean, it happens sometimes. But most people, by the time they're ready to start a project, by the time they have the sort of acumen to go and do it, they already understand all these concepts because they're just common knowledge. So I think that this is getting a lot better. And so I think there'll be less issues with this in the future.
Yeah, I mean,
fewer issues. Sorry, I misspoke there. Fewer issues.
Yeah. Well, one of my issues with, say, the likes of the Pirate Party, I don't want to get too political about it, is the fact that they originally were talking about the abolition of all copyright, and I thought straight away, well, what does that mean for free software? And I know that Pirate Party UK, a lot of the people involved in that are free software people, and they, to be fair to them, they did, I think, consult with RMS about this, because they were talking about a fixed term five-year copyright on everything. I think after they spoke with RMS, he said 10 years would be okay for free software.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, so I think they came to an agreement. But as is, anyway, we're rambling away here, so we should probably think about moving to the next topic.
we should move on. I mean, I think my main point is that I think the level of discourse and knowledge in the community is getting better, so I think it'll be easier for people to start projects. And hopefully they won't have problems like we're about to talk about in the next segment.
Cool. So it's usually Karen who calls for a musical interlude, as I know, because I have to cut them in. but yeah, let's have a little quick musical interlude and then move on to our next topic then. Okay, so we're going to talk about another topic which kind of relates to what we've already discussed in terms of licensing and project governance and all that kind of stuff. There's been a lot of news in the last week and in the last, year in fact, or more, concerning OpenOffice and LibreOffice. And I thought it'd be a good idea if we get the kind of historical context first, because I always worry that perhaps some people don't know the context of what we're talking about. The other thing is, I think this audience is very technical, so a lot of you may know this. So bear with us, but just very, very quickly, can you give us a little bit of a background to this situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes. It's an interesting trajectory. I think it goes back way back when OpenOffice.org was launched. What happened was, there was a time when people thought you might still have Unix desktops. And there was the big challenge was, how do we have an office suite for Unix? And there was this German company that had developed this program called StarOffice, that was pretty far along and it worked. And Sun decided to acquire it in hopes of basically making a desktop, for Solaris. And also to foil Microsoft somewhat, they made sure it already ran on Windows. So they also made sure there was a Windows version available and maintained that as well. So StarOffice was a proprietary software product from, originally from this other company. I don't even remember the name of the company these days. Maybe it was called StarOffice. I don't know, but it doesn't really matter. And then Sun took it over and produced it as a proprietary product. And as free software became more popular and the whole open source fad got started, Sun decided to release it under a free software license and run it. Initially they were going to run it as basically it was a proprietary relicensing model. They kept the Star Office stuff around, but they had a code base out there that was under a free software license. It was under LGPL. And there was actually a lot of acrimony in the GNOME community in particular. That was the community I was following much more closely, because another project had started called AbbeyWord, which is still around, that was trying to write something from scratch. And so there was actually a lot of acrimony of what code base to use. And actually, Michael Meeks, who plays a big part of the story going forward, was an advocate in the GNOME community of we should be contributing to OpenOffice. We should get OpenOffice to be the default GNOME desktop suite, and so forth. So back in, this sort of brings us up to like 2001, 2002 timeframe. Michael was out there advocating for people, and in fact, advocating for people to assign copyright to Sun, because Sun went around requiring people to assign any copyrights if they wanted it in the main code base to Sun, because Sun was still relicensing it out under proprietary licenses as Star Office, and also signed a deal with IBM, which comes into play later in the story. So they had signed a deal with IBM, and IBM integrated it with various products. In the meantime, IBM bought Lotus Notes, and they made Symfony, which was a Lotus Notes project, into their sort of, I guess it's their company corporate integration suite or whatever you call it.
I don't productivity know what you call it. Suite or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so they integrated Star Office, proprietary version of OpenOffice, into that and had the code base. And so they had a special license from Sun, all of which worked because Sun had all these copyright assignments from individual developers so that they could take the LGPL version and make it proprietary. So that's sort of what leads us up to the moment when Sun buys Oracle.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, Oracle buys, I said that backwards. Oracle buys Sun. Sun is sold to Oracle.
Yeah, I was going to say that would have been interesting.
Yeah, I don't think Sun had the capitalization to make that
No,
happen.
Unfortunately not. So, yeah, I mean, this is, I'm sure everyone will have seen this. I mean, it's been big news. But obviously Oracle came along, acquired Sun and all of their projects, including many open source projects, actually, not just OpenOffice, but things like VirtualBox, which, okay, has another dual licensing model. But then, you know, there was other things in there, or lots of projects that people were worried about.
Like MySQL,
or, you know, that was a big one, obviously. Yeah, Hudson as well is another one. There's so many, really. But basically, because of that, I mean, I as far as I understand it, because of the acquisition, lots of developers who've been working on OpenOffice got a little worried about the future of it and so on. And there were lots of discussions going on about what they should do. And eventually a fork was made, which has come to be known as LibreOffice, under the Document Foundation, which is this foundation they set up to go forward with this. So where do we go from there then?
Well, so the interesting thing about the fork was that this was a build-up. The Oracle acquisition of Sun was really the last straw more than it was the catalyst, I think.
Right.
Because the OpenOffice.org developer, the people contributing to it, were already very frustrated. There were lots of patches not finding their way in. There was lots of shenanigans going on that really aren't worth getting into. And frankly, a lot of them are unsubstantiated rumor. But I heard enough of those rumors that I'm pretty sure that at least some of them are true or no smoke without fire.
Whatever they say.
That's right. So the Oracle acquisition and Oracle taking control of OpenOffice was basically a last straw for the non-affiliated developers. And by non-affiliated, I don't mean that they're not work for companies. A lot of them, for example, work for Novell, and some work for Red Hat, and some work for Canonical, and so forth. But they're sort of not affiliated with the two big corporate powers, Oracle and IBM, in the OpenOffice community. And they were already frustrated. They didn't like this deal, this side deal that Sun and now Oracle had with IBM over the code base. And there were lots of the shenanigans were basically related to small companies that were trying to get into the OpenOffice office market. We're sort of being squelched by Oracle and IBM for various reasons. I even heard this scheme to get around it, which was that they would get these small companies would get the unaffiliated OpenOffice.org developers to submit bug reports, because if Oracle saw, or Sun at the time saw, that it was a bug report from one of their competitors, they basically would give it lower priority. It was really kind of sick mess. And so all these kind of shenanigans were really bothering the project. And this goes back to what I was saying in the last segment about the license being kind of the constitution of the community. Well, the constitution of the community was all your base will belong to us. It was basically you assign everything to Oracle, or it gives it back to you under LGPL, but we're off doing the proprietary licensing thing. And people have probably seen me talk about how proprietary licensing is dangerous. And so the LibreOffice people, they basically had the last straw with the Oracle acquisition, because Oracle's such a worse. I mean, Sun was actually trying, I think. Sun wanted to be a more open source company, and they were trying to become one. But Oracle has really no interest in that. And so that just made it clear that there wasn't that the problems. I think everybody held out hope that Sun was going to fix some of these problems, but they knew that Oracle was not going to. So the Oracle acquisition was just kind of a last straw. And you're right, they started this foundation. It's a German foundation, and I think it's great that they started a nonprofit. I believe it's an EV in Germany that they're using to house LibreOffice and make sure that it's operated in a not-for-profit way. And they forked under LGPL, which is permitted, and they created a fork that, and immediately they brought in lots of changes that people hadn't assigned to Sun, because Sun and Oracle would never take changes that weren't assigned, because it wouldn't allow them to license this ideal to IBM. It wouldn't allow them to make the proprietary Star Office out of it. So they immediately pulled in lots of those patches. They immediately pulled in people from smaller companies that were trying to do consulting around the code base and so forth. And distributions quickly switched to LibreOffice, and basically, I mean, SUSE obviously switched because a lot of the engineers working on LibreOffice worked for Novell, but also Canonical switched Ubuntu to LibreOffice, Fedora switched to LibreOffice. So basically all of the main distributions have switched. Debian, I guess, hasn't switched, mainly because they released Squeeze. Squeeze was frozen before LibreOffice came out, so right, they won't be able to switch Squeeze. But I don't know what's actually happening in SID with regard to Debian. I bet both are, but now packaged.
Yeah, quite possibly. It's an interesting situation. Something I must have kind of misunderstood historically was the license that OpenOffice has, well, and since it was open source, they've always been under LGPL. I didn't realize that, because I probably mistakenly assumed that they would use something like CCDL, which they've used for a lot of their other things like Java and OpenSolaris and stuff. So why did they choose LGPL?
No, as I understand it, most of the code base, there's various different licenses across the code base, but the primary license that's on most files, as I understand it, is LGPLv3 only, or disjunctive or with the Mozilla license, Mozilla's public license. So that most of the code base is under that. I think the effective license of the whole thing is now LGPLv3 only, because there's a lot of code that's been brought in under LGPL. And so when you look at the specifically LibreOffice code base, basically its default license is LGPLv3 only, because they've brought so much stuff in, although a lot of the code could be taken under the Mozilla public license as well. They switched to LGPLv3 when it came out, and it was actually one of the projects that did, which I thought was pretty interesting, that they switched to that. And good, because I'm a fan of the LGPLv3. Yeah. It was originally under, I believe, LGPLv2.1 only, or Mozilla. I think that was the dual license then as well. By dual license, I don't mean the relicensing, which is something different. I mean a disjunctive license between two choices. In that case. So I think that's been the license basically since the free software release back in the early 2000s. I could be wrong about that. Because Oracle could unilaterally, Sun in those days, could unilaterally change the license at any time it wanted. It may have changed a number of times. I don't know what it was each moment historically, but I know what it is now.
So, I mean, to kind of speed forward a bit, because we've kind of exhausted the backstory there, and I know lots of people will be rolling their eyes and thinking, well, I know this anyway, why, you know, what does it matter? So the big developments in the last week, I think few days ago, is that Oracle have now submitted or proposed, if you like, OpenOffice as an Apache Foundation project, and they want to switch to Apache 2.0 license, which is obviously... well, it's caused a lot of problems and so on. So what's happening there, do you think?
Well, so what I think has happened is that LibreOffice was a successful fork. I think that there were so many people who have been so pent up and annoyed with Sun and now Oracle for so long that people just flocked to LibreOffice. And Michael, I think, knew this was going to happen. And most of the developers who weren't affiliated with IBM or Oracle knew that once they forked, it would really take off. I mean, I basically, because of my connections in the community, I knew the fork was happening before it was announced. And yeah. It was actually, I did some behind the scenes stuff to try and help them get the fork going. Actually, the things I tried to help them with actually didn't pan out, although I did my best. Basically, I helped them with trying to figure out what to do with regard to the foundation and so forth. In the end, it made the most sense for them just to form their own foundation. This was a long time coming, and I think what happened was is people just flocked to it, and Oracle kind of had this reaction of, well, we don't know what to do now. And it was IBM who was most concerned, right? Because Oracle is not that, I think you said this earlier, that they weren't, that it wasn't why they, but they didn't buy Sun to get Open Office.
No.
And so it was sort of like Oracle was like, what do we do with this asset we have? And the main thing was is the deal with IBM. And IBM is really politically savvy about open source and free software. They should not be underestimated. They're not necessarily always a friend to software freedom. In fact, they usually aren't. If you look at their horrible anti-free software filing in the Bilski case in as an amicus brief, you'll see that they're not a friend to free software most of the time, although they try to play themselves out to be. And this is really a manipulation tactic, primarily by IBM, although backed by Oracle, obviously, because Oracle had to agree to the relicensing, to try and build consensus, to use the Chomsky term, manufacture consensus that everybody wants to switch to an Apache licensed open office code base.
Yeah.
I think the Apache Foundation, I'm troubled that they were willing to make this deal because I think they sort of naively, I think they're being naive on purpose. I think they know that this is a political move by IBM, that the guys who run Apache Foundation, and it is all guys, I'm sorry to say, they're smart. And they understand free software politics. They must know that this is an IBM manipulation tactic. And I think for principled reasons, they're allowing this to basically, they're basically allowing themselves to act naively about, oh, this is just another project applying, entering our incubator period and all this stuff. Because I think they have no other way to uphold the principles of the Apache Software Foundation at the same time, doing the right thing. So I sort of get why they're doing it and why they're acting kind of naive about it. I don't think they are naive. I think they're just acting naive. But basically this is an IBM tactic. It's a classic IBM political maneuver. And if you read Rob Weir's blog, who's sort of been the spokesperson IBM has put forward to talk about this, it's a very manipulative blog post that's trying to convince people that somehow this is great for free software. It misquotes the FSF. I've commented on the blog about why it's misquoting FSF, saying, oh yeah, FSF loves the Apache license. Well, the FSF likes the Apache license when a project's already permissively licensed, but FSF doesn't go around saying switch from copyleft to permissive. That would be like counter FSF's mission in a lot of ways. So he sort of quotes FSF out of context, saying, oh, they endorsed Apache. Well, they didn't endorse this. It's a lot of manipulation going on, trying to get people to come back. And they're basically trying to play LibreOffice like, oh, they're a nasty fork that's angry at us and won't come cooperate on our code base. But there's a license change that they basically shifted the foundation to make a pun, of the OpenOffice/LibreOffice community, saying, oh, we're going to Apache relicense all the underlying code. And why won't you come contribute under the Apache license? What do you have against the Apache license? What do you have against the Apache process? Well, there was already a community there. The community was designed around LGPL. Oracle had a special license outside of LGPL, and IBM had one too because of its deal with Sun/Oracle. And so this change is basically trying to make IBM and Oracle seem like they were all friendly all along, when in fact it's really just trying to nail a you know, put nails in the coffin of the fork of LibreOffice. And it's really it's politics, and I've tried to analyze it as everybody look at this and see that it's politics. Don't look at this as naively on its face and say, oh well, they're just trying to get right by the open office community or something. No, this is a last ditch effort. Oracle announced a few weeks ago they were giving up on open office, and all of a sudden IBM steps in and now they're doing this. And this is basically a last ditch effort to try and keep basically IBM control over the open office code base, because Oracle doesn't really care about it anymore. So anyway, that's my rant about the whole topic. I'm sorry, I got a little ranty there, but that's sort of my thinking on what's happened.
Yeah, so I'm assuming, well, obviously we can only speculate, but I would assume that you mentioned Symfony and some of the other products that IBM are shipping. I would imagine that they're proprietary, you know, products and stuff that have taken from the OpenOffice codebase rely on the OpenOffice codebase not, you know, staying up to date and not withering away and dying, which could happen if Oracle just dumped it and all the rest of it. So that would seem to me as an outsider to be the motivation to keep the thing going, which is what you're saying, yeah, to keep, because they need to keep the upstream going for their product that they're going to sell later on.
But to be very clear about it, they need an upstream that will give them a license that's not copylefted, right?
Yeah.
They had that because Sun/Oracle, and mostly Sun, because Oracle sort of was already sort of crumbling the open office situation once they bought Sun. But basically that copyright assignment that Sun had from all the developers created an upstream that gave IBM a de facto permissive license, in the sense that IBM had an exclusive, semi-exclusive license from Sun/Oracle that made sure that they could build Symfony and other proprietary stuff on top of it and integrate it in a way that didn't require them to adhere to copyleft terms. And so what they see, what IBM is really savvy. They know what's going on. And they see, the code base, the sort of center of non-IBM development, non-Oracle development, is now centering around copyleft, and that screws our business model. So as a last-ditch effort, let's convince Oracle to permissively license the whole darn thing. Let's put it in the Apache Software Foundation, because that has some credibility, and basically bank on Apache Software Foundation's credibility to try and effectively manipulate developers into contributing under the Apache license instead of under the copyleft license that LibreOffice is already under. Mm. And that's what the public relations messaging is coming out of IBM. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to say, you don't really need copyleft. Come over and contribute in the Apache Software Foundation. You all love the Apache Software Foundation, don't you?
Mm.
Come on, they're nice guys, they're smart, they're friendly, they got community cred. Come contribute under that license instead of copyleft. That's what has me angry. That's what I think is insidious.
Now, listening to that that argument, it makes me wonder what Apache have got to gain out of this, because as far as I can see, all they're going to do is take the heat for what other people are doing. So I don't see why they would, as you mentioned, that they obviously, well, it seems as though they must be smart enough to know what the situation is. So I can't understand why they would openly walk into this, you know, walk in front of a gun, basically, for IBM and other people, because they've got such credibility over the years that they're kind of throwing some of that away, or so it seems.
Well, there are a couple of factors in that. The first one, which is, I'm not sure which one to say, the one that's kind to Apache Software Foundation or somewhat critical first. The kind one is this. I think the Apache Software Foundation guys, as they approached the situation, I bet you they had an internal conversation that said, we have to treat this like any other project. We know there's a political situation here, but from their point of view, if they were to say, no, we won't accept it because it's a political hot potato,
right,
that would have sort of been they basically would have made an exception to their own processes, right? Because Apache's processes basically say, if you come to us with a project, if you're willing to relicense it under the Apache license, and if you're willing to put it through our incubator process, we will accept and let you enter the incubator process. And the incubator process is a proving ground for new projects to become part of the Apache Software Foundation. And that process is well publicly documented and it's open to everyone. And I think it would have been tough for the Apache Software Foundation to say, no, you can't enter this incubator period because you're a political hot potato, because we know you're trying to basically mess with the fork. I think it would have been wrong. Actually, I think it would have been wrong for them to refuse in some ways, because I think that would have killed their credibility of the incubator process. And so for that reason, I think they were sort of stuck in their ability, and that's why they're sort of publicly stating this in somewhat of a naive point of view. I think the less friendly answer to that, I probably get emails if any Apache Software Foundation folks listen to this, is that Apache's always had a rather close relationship with IBM. Most people in the free software community won't know this, so I'll tell the story. It's going to take a moment, but I think it's worth it. So when Apache Software Foundation was founded, it was actually to make a deal with IBM. So Apache was, obviously people know it as the web server. Yeah. That was what the first thing Apache Software Foundation did. In fact, the web server predates it. It was a set of patches to the last free software version released by Netscape, because Netscape had a server product. This is way back. This is about I'm talking 1995 era stuff. Okay. Netscape had this, it was actually 94, I think, had this web server they sort of threw over the wall, because they were developing Netscape in sort of a quasi-free software way initially, and then they got corporate funding, and what's his name came in and funded them, and they basically all went proprietary. So there was this last release of HTTPD that Netscape had put out under a permissive license. And Brian Benneldorf and a few other people were patching it, and they had made this thing they called Apache Server, in the sense it written as A-PATCH-Y. Basically, they had made a bunch of patches to the last Netscape release of HTTPD, and they worked, and they were doing pretty well. And so that this became, as you get into the late 90s, the default server that people were using, because it was built on this old code, but had been improved, and this community had gotten together to make patches for it. And it was Apache Server. And that's how they got the name. And so they had that out there, and IBM wanted to build a product on it, because they wanted to enter this was like web.com era, right? This is 1999, 2000 era. They wanted to make a web server product, which was called WebSphere, if people have heard of.
I remember WebSphere.
Exactly. So there is this class. So I was at the very first, it was the very first OSCON, and it wasn't even OSCON yet. It was a day after the Perl conference. O'Reilly ran an event called the Open Source Developer Day in 1998. Mm. And there was this panel about corporate adoption of free software. And open source, the term had just been coined. Most people are still saying free software in those days, which I miss those days. So there was this panel, and basically, Brian Benneldorf, who had just started the Apache Software Foundation, talking to IBM about their adoption of Apache. And he classically put out this quote that an IBM executive said in a meeting, "Apache is just a website. How in the hell can I make a deal with a website?" And that was the classic quote that sort of became why open source had to grow up. Eric Raymond talked a lot about this. Open source needs to grow up. I don't really like that phrase, but that was sort of the sense of we needed to build structures and organizations. And Apache Software Foundation was basically launched to be able to make a deal with IBM for IBM to adopt Apache and put it inside WebSphere in the true permissive license way, right? But WebSphere was going to be a proprietary software product, and IBM wanted to contribute some of the changes back, but not many, and all that sort of thing. So that was the design of Apache Software Foundation. That was how it all came to be. And so there's this relationship with IBM going way back.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, I'd never actually I can't believe I never realized that the name was almost like a joke. I never really thought about it. Yeah, it makes sense. So the thing is, at the moment, I mean, I've read the blog post that you referenced by Rob Weir, and it seems as though it's going to take a long time for this to go through the incubator project process, sorry, and all the rest of it. And people are saying it could be a year before we really see this come through the whole process and so on and become a proper Apache Foundation project. By that time, it seems to me that LibreOffice will have come on, you know, who knows how much further in that time. So we'll end up with these two different code bases. And it makes me wonder whether the OpenOffice code base will still be up to date enough by that time for it to compete, you know.
Yeah, I think it's going to be complicated. I mean, this is why the PR machine of IBM is sort of out there pushing in the community. And I hope people won't be fooled by it. I don't think they will, but maybe. But basically, IBM needs to attract developers in the true Steve Ballmer shouting sense.
Yeah.
They need people to come during the incubator period. Because the thing about the incubation period in Apache is the project still goes on. It's not like it just sits there and does nothing. The whole point of the incubation period is to show that you have a community of developers who want to contribute and be involved and all that sort of thing. So basically, what IBM's going to do, what Oracle's presumably going to do, is they're going to push all the code out under Apache 2.0 license. IBM will probably start feeding the typical IBM thing where they feed a few patches, the classic WebSphere thing where they give a couple of patches, they fix bugs, they do the basics and push stuff out there, but they won't put tons of stuff into it because really what they're focused on is their proprietary forks.
Yeah.
But they'll push some things back. And so that'll sort of go along there. Now what I'm sure LibreOffice is going to try to do, and I hope they do, is try and basically take the best of that and bring it into LibreOffice. Right. So the neat thing, and this is a real upside of the fact that OpenOffice is LGPL v3, is because Apache license is fully compatible with that, Apache 2.0. So they can bring stuff into the copyleft version and sort of combine, assuming technically they can do that. It's technically tough sometimes when you have two code bases that have diverged to really bring patches back. But hopefully they can. Licensing wise, it's no problem. So they can keep pulling stuff in and be a feeder off of what's happening in the incubation process. My hope is that they do that. That they basically just drink the milkshake of what anything that gets done in the Apache space. Now, normally I'm against this kind of activity. I'm normally against the idea of sitting there and feeding off of a permissively licensed project and pulling it into a copyleft one. My normal position is if a project is permissively licensed in the spirit of collaboration, even if you're a copyleft person, you should be willing to contribute under permissive license. The reason I'm making an exception to that general rule in this case is because the project was already copylefted and somebody else who happened to be a major copyright holder came along and decided to force permissive license down people's throats. Because that's the way this thing played out, I'm taking a different stance than I usually would. I'm saying, look, the copyleft guys should just keep taking code from the Apache guys. So I think you're right that LibreOffice is going to keep moving. Not for the reason you said. I don't think it's going to be like it's going to sit in the incubation and nothing's going to happen. I think IBM puts an effort behind getting code into the Apache licensed version. But I think basically they're just going to be a feeder to LibreOffice, and LibreOffice will continue to move forward, as you say. And continue to get better.
Yeah, well, this is something that when I was reading through the ton of comments on that post that Rob Weir made, that our mutual friend Jeremy Allison made the point that about the fact that because of the licensing situation, LibreOffice can take the Apache the Apache 2.0 license stuff that gets added to OpenOffice codebase and incorporate it. But the same thing can't happen the other way because of the license of LibreOffice. So it seems that, a lot of people have kind of trying to promote, and I think I don't want to kind of put, you know, paraphrase what Jeremy said too much because, he probably wouldn't like that. But what he seemed to be saying to me was that he would like to see the OpenOffice people actually collaborate more, you know, proactively with the LibreOffice and actually get together more in that kind of way. And as you said, he also said something I thought was quite interesting, which is this is a copyleft versus non-copyleft kind of argument, and people are trying to say that it's not and trying to say that it's something else, but it seems like at the core of it, it is the fact that one license is a copyleft license, the other is not. That seems the way it looks to me from the outside, anyway.
I think you're absolutely right. I think you'll see me in posting. I'm going to obviously link to this blog post in the show notes. You'll see me commenting there, saying, "Well said, Jeremy." Because I think Jeremy was right on to say this is copyleft versus non-copyleft. That's what's going on here. I mean, I think that basically. I have a rather, it's probably obvious from this show and others that I have a pretty negative view of IBM in most cases. And so I think IBM is going to do everything they can, to try and make it difficult for, LibreOffice to make good use of the patches, that are put into the Apache version. Because I think basically their goal is to make sure the copyleft version is not the default. So they don't want to be a feeder in any sort of way. I think Michael Meeks and all the other LibreOffice developers will be happy to collaborate with IBM, and happy to take the code. And I bet you they would even be willing in very small cases to give a few patches back, to the permissive licensed one. But they're not going to wholesale just all switch and develop under the permissive license going forward. This is a group of people who want a copyleft. And this is what I was sort of talking about in the last segment, that the LGPL, I know the LibreOffice community is somewhat young because they only recently forked, but they forked because they wanted to be, they saw the problems of a copyright assigned program to Oracle that was licensed back out under a copyleft. They want a pure copyleft community now. That's the community they want. That's the community they created. Granted, they're only, what, six months old now. But the thing is, they're a six-month-old community that has a culture. And they have a culture which is steeped in fights with Oracle over the licensing. And so they've got a license they want. And for IBM to say, well, you should just now switch to this license because IBM says so, that's just disingenuous. It's arrogant and disingenuous in my view. And I think those two adjectives describe IBM for sort of completely in my mind.
Right. In your opinion. Yeah.
Obviously it's my opinion.
Yeah. It's an interesting situation. I think, this idea that we're going to have two competing code bases, I don't know. I've said on other shows in the past, maybe, to be honest, I didn't really understand the full implications of, well, this was before the license change for a start, but I didn't really understand the full implications. I knew I said implementations there. That's a completely wrong word. Of this whole political situation. But from a kind of an end user point of view, who wants to get the best software we can, and hopefully under a copyleft license, from my point of view, though everyone wouldn't agree, it would be good to see a lot of these developers who are now divided kind of working together more. But the actual reality of that is more difficult, because what license do they collaborate under? How does it affect, as you said, I'm sure lots of PR stuff would coming out of IBM, it's kind of very easy for them now to say people who are holding out and saying they won't contribute under Apache are just being difficult and they're fundamentalists and they're not being good, they're not being good citizens and trying to help the community and stuff, they're just being difficult. And I think that's quite sad, really.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be the first time IBM tried to play this game with a free software community. It's probably not even the third time. This is an IBM tactic. I said this in my blog post, that IBM really get the open source and free software world. I mean, they really understand it. That's why in some ways they're so dangerous, because they understand it. They understand how to exploit it as a company in a way that nobody else does. Microsoft has no clue. Apple kind of has no clue on this. They're sort of simplistic in the way that they exploit FreeBSD and other permissively licensed projects. IBM are the real political savvy ones who get it. And I'm impressed by their level of political savvy. But at the same time, they are just basically a worthy adversary, because their goal is not the goal of free software at all. Their goal is to be IBM and the same IBM they've always been, the same IBM that my dad told me stories of they would put a special card in your computer that made it run slower, and you bought the upgrade and all they did was come out and pull out that card. That's the IBM that's always been. And no matter what sort of friendly face they put on it to the community, that's who they are. And I think that people have to remember that. That's not to say we can't collaborate, right? I mean, there's lots of cases that IBM's contributed to the Linux kernel, a big contributor to the Linux kernel, which is great. And they contribute under GPL and all that sort of thing. And they're contributed to GCC. They're contributed to lots of free software projects. And they assign their copyrights on GCC to FSF. So they are a contributor, and we can take their code and we can appreciate their contributions for what they are. And we can thank them for that. We can say, hey, this is great that you're doing that. But it doesn't mean that every action they take in the free software community is good for the community, just because some of them are. And I think people paint these companies with a really broad stroke. And I learned this from RMS actually years ago, that you look at every specific action in effectively isolation. You say, is this action that this company is taking good for free software or bad for free software? And you analyze each one separately, and you thank them for the stuff they're doing that's good, and you have to criticize them for the stuff they're doing that's bad.
Mm. Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, looking forward, going forward with this, I mean, obviously, we haven't got a crystal ball and we're not going to be able to tell the future. But I'm curious, how do you think this is likely to play out? Because I can see, you know, a year down the line, we could end up with two competing products, as I said, or projects. But obviously, each will be hoping that they will be the preferred option, and they will, you know, it's like a head-to-head race, that they will get ahead of the others and so on. So obviously, I'm assuming that the people behind the Apache version will hope that by this time next year, all of the LibreOffice, or the ones that they see as important, LibreOffice developers maybe, will have decided to start contributing under Apache, and that will be the default. But I don't know, do you think that will happen, or do you think we'll end up with two competing Office suites with diverging code bases?
So if anybody wants to take bets, everybody knows I'm a betting fellow, and I will lay people. But we have to come up with some metric, but I would easily lay 3-1 that LibreOffice will be the one that succeeds. And I don't know how you judge that. I actually think the biggest judge, and this is the main point I want to make on that question, is how do we know which one's succeeding? I think we look at the distributions. The GNU Linux distributions, which version they make the default is gonna, it, not only is that gonna be the, it's gonna be both the litmus test of who's succeeding, and it's also gonna be the either death march or winning of one of them, right? Because if the distributions are all like sort of behind LibreOffice, obviously SUSE is gonna stay behind LibreOffice because they invest so much in its development. But when you look at Ubuntu, Fedora, and Debian, those will be the sort of the major ones to look at. Who they stick with, that's gonna decide. If those three, because we obviously know SUSE is gonna stay with LibreOffice till the bitter end. Basically they would have to fire the team to switch, I would think.
Yeah.
But you look at the other three major ones. If they stick with LibreOffice for the long term, then OpenOffice under Apache has no chance. It'll be an IBM code dump sort of thing that maybe gets a patch or two on occasion. It's just not going to survive because the distributions are going to decide that they want to move forward. Also, the LibreOffice guys are smartly continuing the Windows version to make sure that they... Because one thing that could happen is it could split the baby, right? The OpenOffice one could somehow become the standard Windows one, and the one on GNU Linux systems could stay LibreOffice. I think the Document Foundation folks are smart enough to realize they have to keep the Windows version going. I'm not nuts. I don't care about the Windows version, right? I mean, because I'm who I am. But I think that it's shrewd of them to make sure they have the Windows version. And it's good to give people free software on Windows. If people are stuck on Windows, having a free software alternative is good. It's just not my forte. But I think it's really smart that LibreOffice has decided we're going to stay cross-platform. So as long as they do that, I think that LibreOffice is they're ahead. I mean, they got ahead really fast, and they're going to stay ahead. I think it's going to be tough to catch up to them, especially when basically it's obviously a thinly veiled IBM plan to get code from people. I mean, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned about the distributions the major distributions kind of moving towards LibreOffice and swapping and stuff. But I don't know. This is a discussion that was happening on the comments to that blog post, that some people seem to feel that it's an ideological thing and that's why. But when you look at the comments coming out of the likes of Canonical, you can see it's clear clearly not an ideological reason that they've done this. At the time, they thought Open Office was going away and it was dead and it was, you know, whatever. So they kind of moved because they felt they had to, I think. As you say, Sousa and Novell is a different case because they're so invested in this. I don't know what to say about Red Hat. I've really no idea. But yeah, I think it was Rob Weir who quoted Mark Shuttleworth's recent comments on his blog there in reply to someone saying, I think Mark Shuttleworth broadly kind of paraphrased and said something like, Sun made this amazing gift to the open source community and certain, you know, people, groups and factions threw it in their face and made a thingy and whatever else. So listening to his kind of rhetoric, he doesn't sound like a guy who's ideologically aligned with LibreOffice in any way to me. So I don't know what they will do. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. There's not. This is a classic good point of rhetoric that it's kind of correct, right? It is correct that Sun gave a gift by releasing it, and it's an appreciated gift. I think it's great that they released the code base as free software. But it doesn't mean that they get to coast on that achievement, right? We can thank them for the gift, and we did at the time. This is going back many years now. It's 10 years ago.
Yeah.
11 years ago. We thanked them for the gift at the time, and everybody was appreciative that they were released it as free software, but it doesn't mean that analogize it to like normal life, right? Just because somebody, you know, comes over your house and brings you a bottle of wine, you're like, oh, thank you for this gift. Heck, maybe even if somebody gives you a house, it does, you know, because maybe you could argue that this gift is so good as giving somebody a house. It doesn't mean that like, well, okay, we gave you this house, but anytime you want to make an addition on it, you know, you're going to need to talk to us, and anytime you want to, you know, want to hang some pictures on the wall, you're going to have to talk to. I mean, it's sort of like, is this really a gift or am I just your tenant, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of what happened. I think that's the best analogy is that they gave the house to the community and then said, well, yeah, but you're really just renting the house from us. It's not really like it's a gift to you. And so that's the response that you're seeing is they sort of gave a gift with strings attached, and the LibreOffice community finally said no more on that, and that's why the fork happened. I think it's just as you said, it's just rhetoric, and I think that IBM's going to try really hard to make it seem like that's a community there, but there's no community there. Oracle already announced they're giving up on OpenOffice, so it is an IBM project now housed in the Apache Software Foundation. That's the long and short of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly seems like it. And I nearly said we'll keep an eye on it, which is my favorite phrase from Linux Outlaws, as you know. But yeah, I think, we await future developments with interest. But I think we've pretty much exhausted that topic for now. So we should probably move towards the end and wrap things up.
I have. Let's do another music thing, and I have one short segment that I want to do with you, as to finish up, and then we're getting close to the end. That's definitely true.
Cool. So let's have a quick music break, and we'll be back in a second.
So Dan, I just want to, because this is this was a special case where you were on our show. I just wanted to, and I hope I don't embarrass you with this, I just wanted to tell you, you know, how much Karen and I appreciate all the work you've done to help Free and Freedom happen. And I'm glad the listeners, obviously they can hear you on your many other podcast endeavors. But I'm glad they got to hear you a little bit on the show. And I just want I listened to your episode 200 of Linux Outlaws that you did with Fab talking about the production. And I listened very closely to you saying a couple times, well, yeah, the editing's the hardest part. Yeah, the editing's the most work and it takes this many hours to do editing. And Karen and I have it kind of easy. We basically get together once every 2 weeks. We slap down some recordings. It literally just takes the amount of time we're talking. I mean, we talk for like 15 minutes before about what we're going to talk about, and we just do it. But you do the hard work, and this is what's made this Oddcast happen. And since the old show, the Software Freedom Law Show, we used to do all the way into Freeze and Freedom, you've been the force that's made this happen. And I just wanted to, with you on the air, well, not air because it's recorded, but to sort of with you here speaking, to publicly thank you so much. You make Freeze and Freedom happen. I've referenced the silent partner thing. You always have been. You've been the person that makes it all happen, and you do it completely as a volunteer, and always have. And it's so appreciated. Karen and I know I speak for Karen when I say this, that Karen and I really appreciate it. And we just basically, if you couldn't do it anymore for whatever reason, which I would understand, you're a volunteer, volunteers move on all the time, but basically we'd end the show because we have no ability to do it without you, and which would be fine if you ever have to move on, we'd understand. But basically you are the linchpin. It's funny that your last name is Lynch. you are the linchpin of the show. It's a fitting name.
Oh, well, thank you very much. That's very kind. And I always enjoy helping out because I think it's an important show, and I don't think, you know, there aren't many other shows that have certainly the legal knowledge that Karen brings, and yourself through your experience of many years with FSF and then SFLC and now at Conservancy and so on. So I think it's really important. And as far as the editing thing goes, I have to confess it's far easier. I don't know whether I don't know why, but it's always far easier for me to edit this show than it is to edit Linux Outlaws. It takes a lot longer to edit Linux Outlaws. I think it's probably because when you're kind of personally involved in something and your voice is on it as well, you worry more about every little phrase being right and cutting out every time you say or you have a break or something. That's not to say that I don't edit intensively as much as I can with and make it as good as I can when I do Freeze and Freedom, but it's definitely a lot easier. So, I mean, it's not too bad. It takes a couple of hours every couple of weeks. So, I mean, it's no great hardship, and I enjoy helping out. So no problem.
Yeah, well, we definitely really appreciate it. We do our best to sort of do it in just a few takes and make sure that there's sort of just a couple of segments that need to be pasted together to make the editing job as easy as possible. We do think about that every time. We're sort of like, well, if we do it this way, will it be harder to edit? We always try to think of that to make it easy on you. But all the same, it's still work regardless, no matter how much we try to make it easy. So we just really appreciate it. And I'm glad the listeners got to enjoy you as a co-presenter for a while. And I guess you'll go back to being our silent partner, but I want the listeners to know that you are the thing that as a producer that makes this thing actually work.
Oh, thank you. It's very kind. And as you say, I'm sure I'll return to being a silent partner, but who knows, maybe sometime in the future, if the universe needs me, I'll come back. You know, there's some sci-fi reference there somewhere, I'm sure, when the time is right.
Right. Well, and particularly with in the last show, you were asking me some really really good, hard pointed questions, which I think were helpful to the listeners. People did give feedback. They liked that show. Okay. So if you ever want to come back and sort of, if there's a topic that's sort of free as in freedom, topic list related, you know, policy, free software policy, ethics, morality, legal, you know, those sort of things that we cover, organizational, that stuff that Karen and I are, that's our bailiwick. If you have a topic you want to ever come back and we can always, I mean, we got the setup now all working. Karen could be sitting next to me if she weren't off on her vacation.
Yeah.
So we could always do that with you in this way. If you ever have a topic, you should let us know and we'll have you on and you can grill us about some topic of your interest and give us your thoughts. So you have an open invitation to be a third co-host, third presenter anytime you want. We'd always welcome you.
Well, I'll definitely keep it in mind. As I said as well, I think, obviously on Linux Outlaws, we don't really have any legal knowledge of these kind of subjects. We just kind of talk about them from our perspective. So it's good to have a more inside thing. But I think we're in danger of making everyone throw up all over their portable media players right now if we keep going on about how fantastic.
I didn't want to turn this into a mutual appreciation society but that's why I saved it for last as the final segment. But since you were on the show, I wanted to really publicly thank you in a way. We have publicly thanked you before, obviously, but I wanted to thank you with you here being able to respond because we do appreciate it so much. And the listeners should know that they hear my and Karen's voice most of the time, but almost all the time, as it turns out. But it's really without producer Dan, there wouldn't be a Freeze and Freedom.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose I consider myself more of a proxy in that situation than anything too more involved, but much more involved. But yeah, it's very cool. So, Karen will be back next time, and yep. I don't know if you've decided what you're going to talk about, but I'm sure it'll be fabulous.
I haven't talked to Karen in weeks because she's been away, so we'll figure it out when she gets back, and I hope it'll be of interest to folks when we have our next show.
Cool. So yeah, stay tuned and don't forget you can always go to faith.us and find notes on the show and links to the stuff that we talked about today and in other shows that Bradley and Karen talk about. There's always lots of links there. And what's the feedback address if people want to send emails and stuff?
It's ogcast@fif.us, and they'll probably hear Karen's voice say that at the end, little end segment.
Oh yeah, sorry, yeah, I forgot that because I'm so used to having to do the wrap up on Linux Outlaws where we do the whole.
Well, I missed the what was his name, the festival voice guy?
The Hawkman.
Yeah, I miss it. I remember listening to one show where you guys were like, we're going to retire the Hawkman now. I miss that.
I think maybe he'll come back. 2.0, a version 2.0 of him might come back. It's been a pleasure talking to you as always. So stay tuned for another Free As in Freedom in a couple of weeks.
Free As in Freedom is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. Free As in Freedom is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 Unported license. Please provide any feedback to ogcast@faif.us.
Cool. All right. Well, everything's okay here. I've switched my phone off so we don't get any interference. Is there sounds like I can hear like a train or something going past or something. There's a noise.
Oh, I wonder if that's my laptop fan. I'll try to move further away. My mic's further away from the. It's probably my laptop is really loud.
Oh right, okay. It sounded a little bit like, I don't know, like an underground those electric trains going past.
It could be. Well, I actually can vaguely hear the subway here, but I don't
think you wouldn't get it as loud as that, I don't think.
Yeah.